Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Bathroom of Your Birth show. Our show's producer is counting down now the shows until he leaves for the summer for North Carolina. And we wanted to give him a big North Carolina send-off by reminding him that he is descending into a Supreme Court civil rights battle regarding who gets to use which bathroom. The sort of things that certainly a progressive state like North Carolina needs to be involved in. So that's the name of the show, and that's about all we're going to talk about it. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio, and with me to
dun dun dun.
Apparently with his own theme song that I did not know about, from the University of Kentucky, Communications Infrastructure Manager Rick Phillips, to tell you about our web presence. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. As you know, WMKY.org is Moorhead State Public Radio's website. It's a place that Tony goes all the time. So, isn't that right, Tony? You spend a lot of time on there, don't you?
You bet.
Yeah, I get it. WMKY.org. Get through those menus, find Health Matters, go to the page. You'll see our more recent shows. The most important part of that, though, is there is a link right there on the page you can click on and listen to the show. So if you missed a part of it, if you've started listening now and then you decided, you know, I'm going to turn this thing off, and then later on you get a case of regret and you say, I need to go back and listen to that. Well, this is where you do it. Hopefully you stayed on long enough to hear me say that, so you'll know how to get back to listen to it. WMKY.org. After that, interact with Health Matters. Jump on Facebook. That's right. We're old. We like Facebook. It's easy. Facebook.com/HMRadioShow. There you will find our fan page, and we did not call it a fan page. That is kind of what Facebook does, because, you know, I'm not sure about fans. Tony, should we say we have fans?
We have fans.
Really?
Well, they comment now. I mean, the Facebook page has been lit up past several weeks.
Well, I noticed you've been noticeably absent on there. It's like you've been traveling or something.
I have. We'll talk about that.
So, Facebook.com, that is the place where you interact. And we've been trying to keep up with you, Facebook. Yes, you've been going nuts lately, but certainly we appreciate that, and we are absolutely reading those posts and trying to respond accordingly. And typically we will. Leave us some show topics, leave us some feedback. Throw in some news that maybe we didn't catch, but the odds are we caught it before you. That's a dare. Yeah, we don't think you can find something. But anyway, Facebook.com/HMRadioShow.
Our sponsor for today's show, Medication Simplification, when pills make you ill. Now, Rick alluded to the fact, he and I, actually, this is a joyous moment. Because,
yes, we've actually been out for a while.
Yeah, we've come
in. It's a triumphant return.
And Hunter,
one of us
credit,
is leaving, two of us are staying.
Yeah, he has cut and pasted from other radio shows and news outlets and so forth, and has concocted some fake Health Matters shows, which you have to say turned out pretty well.
This is pretty easy not to notice, right?
but Rick and I are actually back in the studio to do a show. It's a great moment. And part of the time I spent off, I went to a national meeting of internal medicine, had my mind blown several times just by things that people said, things that you new ways of interpreting old information, and even at my advanced age and my long-standing career, there's still things that make you really excited about medical practice. One of the lectures I went to was a lecture about trying to trim back your medication list. We in the United States, and we'll talk about this more this show, we take too many pills. We just simply do. We take pills. I still remember that classic commercial where you could take a pill that will enable you to go through the drive-thru and order onion rings. And you knew that that was going to cause you to be physically ill with heartburn symptoms.
Oh, but they're so good.
But that's right. And so if you wanted to eat the onion rings, you take the purple pill and it will allow you to do something your body is telling you not to do. So that's the sort of mentality we have. Look, I don't want to learn how to prepare myself for sleep. I would rather take a sleeping pill. I don't want to avoid allergens. I would just rather take an allergy pill. I don't want to avoid onion rings. I would just rather take a heartburn pill, and so forth. So they were talking about how to wean you down off of unnecessary medications. And so here are 10 tips for doctors, but I think you can, as a radio fan, you can listen to this and apply this to your own life. First question, there are 10 questions that the lecturer, a guy named Amir Shah, gave the lecture. First question is, does your healthcare provider know all your medications? And you would be surprised at how hard it is to actually get all of a person's medications. Yes, the pharmacy has them, but there may be more than one pharmacy. You may not be taking them the way the pharmacy says. There may be some additional medicines that we don't know about from another pharmacy, or some medicines that you had left over we thought we had discontinued. All those things, you need to make sure that your doctor knows your medications. It's one way to avoid errors. The second one, which is very obvious, are there any medications that are harmful? That is, if you come in confused and you've been taking a lot of sleeping pills and pain medicines, then we suspect they're actually causing you harm. Third thing, are the medications indicated? That is, again, those heartburn pills are only supposed to be taken for 14 days. Sleeping medicines only for a short period of time. If you've been on sleeping medicines for more than 6 months, heartburn pills for over a year, then those are not indicated in the way that you're taking them. And then four, have they outlived their utility? People don't realize this, but as you get older, your body changes, diseases occur, you lose weight, you gain weight, and things are different than when you were first prescribed these medications. And then number five, do the side effects outweigh the potential benefits? That is always the question we ask. Unfortunately, we doctors tend to minimize the side effects and exaggerate the benefits. A cold, hard look. Cold, hard look at the benefits and side effects. In many cases, the thing just really doesn't even out. That's our sponsor, Medication Simplification, when pills make you ill. First thing, Rick, you've got the answer right in front of you, so you know this, but the device that causes more diaper area injuries to men than anything else in the world. What is the most common cause of injuries to the male equipment in the world?
Well, of course, that's a zipper.
It is.
I don't even need the paper in front of me to answer that one.
This was a guy named Lawrence, and his last name is W-Y-N-E-R. I guess it's Weiner. Honestly, I wanted it to be Wiener, but it probably isn't. He's a urologist. He's at Marshall University in Huntington, and he presented this at the American Urological Association 2016 annual meeting in San Diego. He's only an hour east of here in Huntington, West Virginia, but I get the news release from San Diego, and this thing, I'm sure, really took off. First of all, you need to know the name of zipper-related diaper area injuries. They call it zipper-related penile injury. They call it ZIRPI. Z-I-R-P-I. That's cool.
No.
And this was not his.
This isn't even cool to talk about.
First described in the AMA Journal in 1936, ZIRPI. Many urologists have seen at least one ZIRPI during their career. Risk factors for getting a ZIRPI include age younger than 18. You're a teenager.
Okay.
Not being circumcised. And nobody is certain whether or not going commando actually has anything to do with ZIRPI, but it might. He did a poster presentation, A Century of Urological Mayhem from Zippers, as a part of the History of Urology session. And what's interesting, the one thing that I learned about this is, I'm sure our listeners may be chuckling about this or whatever, these type of injuries are because they occur to young boys, and young boys, let's face it, a lot of things happen to young boys. These things are generally thought to be the consumer's fault.
Consumer.
Right, yeah. You say.
Really?
Is this zipper not safe for teenage boys? Why, no, of course not. Teenage boys are just stupid, and they deserve to get a ZIRPI.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's
slow
the way.
Down.
Yeah. as far as litigation, if you were to sue the pants people because of a ZIRPI, it's generally regarded as frivolous, and probably the outcomes are in fact not in doubt. Zippers have been around now since the 1920s, and Velcro, which would certainly be a lot safer to the male anatomy, has so far been unable to displace zippers, and we expect as long as there are zippers, there will be ZIRPIs.
I told you, that was a sickening topic. I didn't even want to go there. I can't even fathom that. I've managed to avoid that my whole life.
Yeah.
So I'm not one of your silly statistics, of course, now yet.
No, I know, but well,
now
I think
you've just jinxed
again,
us all.
No, teenage boys. I think you get to a point where
yeah, but Tony,
you put
we
your
all
pants
act
on
like teenage
enough.
Boys at times.
I know, but that's a stupid. I think I can probably safely avoid for a number of reasons. But it was something. It is something to talk
now
about.
You really jinxed yourself. You better run outside, turn around three times, and
I do not fear the zipper, Rick. I do not fear the zipper. zipper. Next up, just to change topics.
Please.
This was the CDC National Center for Health Statistics, their data brief from May 2016, and they just asked a question. It was a real simple question. During the past 12 months, have you seen or talked to a doctor in general practice, family medicine, or internal medicine? Not a specialist, but a doctor. Kentucky actually did fairly well in the talk to the doctor. We were at the national average. We were in the second of four tiers. Where do the whiners go? Where are the ones that talk to the doctors all the time? It's kind of interesting. The Northeast, you'd expect that. Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Pennsylvania, Virginia. Tennesseans talk to their doctor a lot. The only 29% of Tennesseans had not seen or talked to their doctor. People from North Dakota, Wisconsin, and Oklahoma talk to their doctor a lot. Who are the ones that do not ever talk to their doctor? Well, it's the Rocky Mountain states. People
really?
In Montana.
Is it just because it's too hard to get to them, you think?
I don't know. Montana was 48% of people had not talked to a doctor in a year. Wyoming, 39%. Utah, 39%. New Mexico, 41.7%. So you just basically go down the Rocky Mountains, and those people do not talk to their doctors. Interesting enough, South Carolina people don't talk to their doctor. That was 41% of them had not seen a doctor, not talked to a doctor in a year. And Mississippi was 39%. Kentucky coming in at 31.9% had not talked to a doctor in a year. Over two-thirds of Kentuckians have at least talked to a doctor in the past year. The highest rate of talking to a doctor was in Vermont, Delaware, Virginia, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, New Hampshire. I think I said that. Those were significantly fewer people had gone without talking to a doctor than the national average. So, you know, I think, and my mother asked me this. I was on the phone. She said, well, I don't know. I guess I ought to go see the doctor. There's nothing wrong with me right now, so I don't know why. My mother, who is in her mid-80s, thought, I'm not sure I should see a doctor. I mean, what would be the purpose?
With a son that's a doctor.
Yeah. Well, I think that, but that's the thing. She says, I could talk to you. And I said, no, you can't. I mean, not about these things. I'm certainly not going to examine my own mother for,
anything.
No, pretty much. I mean, if she wants me to look at her finger, I'll look at her finger. But that's about as far as it goes when you're examining your mom. Doesn't work. And the thing is, I told her, as I said, if you wait, especially if you're in your 80s and you wait till something reaches your attention, that's really bad. That means that this thing has gone so far as it could be a very serious condition. And the people who come in and say, you know, I would never come and see you unless there was something bad wrong. I think, yeah, and that's really your problem. You really do need to establish a relationship with a person. This is your healthcare advisor. This is the person looking out for you. How can someone look out for you and help you? You know, it's sort of like you would say, okay, I've got a stockbroker. I'm not going to visit him unless I go bankrupt. You know, unless
or the market's down 7,000 points.
Yeah. And so at that point, you have no plan at all for managing your finances. You have no plan at all for managing your health. You simply just wait for something bad to happen and then you go in and try to kind of bandage it and duct tape it and all that sort of stuff. I don't know why I said bandage. But I did.
Well, or Tony, I don't know why you say a lot of things. I just don't. I know you're running out of time to say a lot of things.
I am. We're about to run down the first fractional portion. Coming up next, we're going to talk about the FDA regulating e-cigarettes, an exciting development. That'll be in our second fractional portion. We're going to take a break. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio. Stay tuned for our second fractional portion.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Bathroom of Your Birth show. Our salute to our producer, Hunter Reese, who will soon be leaving for a summer in North Carolina. We wanted to make sure he was aware of the firestorm in which he will be descending when he gets to North Carolina. Constitutional issues, Supreme Court issues, civil rights issues, lawsuits from both sides should be an exciting summer for Health Matters radio producer, Hunter Reese. Our sponsor for the second time, medication simplification when pills make you ill. Just reminding you, the number one thing that you can do as a healthcare consumer is make sure that your healthcare provider knows all your medications. That means you take the bottles, you take the actual pills that you're taking, you bring those in, you make a list, and you keep that list with you. You make sure that they know. It is better to get them all at one pharmacy if you can. That way, the pharmacist is also looking out for your medications. But some people will shop pharmacies to get a discount. That I understand that, but really, realize that is a little bit more dangerous than having all your prescriptions at one single pharmacy. The second question that our expert, Amir Shah, who was at the American College of Physicians annual meeting, the second question he asked, are the medications harmful? Are they, in fact, for your particular condition, causing bad side effects or causing harm? Third one, are they indicated? Are you taking them for something that we know that they work for? Because in many cases, people get put on medications for vague reasons and then just continue them. Four, have they outlived their utility? That is, was this treating a condition that you had when you weighed 50 pounds more than this, or when you were in the hospital, or when you lived in a different situation or ate a different diet? Have they outlived their utility? Five, did the side effects outweigh the benefits? Happens a lot with medications, more than we healthcare providers care to admit. Six, are there interactions between two drugs or the drug and the disease? We have some people that have something like Parkinson's, and it turns out one of their medications can make their tremors worse. If you have prostate problems, I just told one of my patients this yesterday, if you have prostate problems and you take sinus medicines and decongestants, they make prostate problems worse. Are you, in fact, aggravating a disease by taking a medication for another symptom? Number seven, what about those over-the-counter things that you've been taking, the supplements, the herbal medications? Those are not, they're not natural. They're not completely interaction-free. A lot of herbal products, a lot of supplements will interact with medicines. Doesn't mean they're bad, but if we don't know about those, then we're not able to assist you with adjusting your medicines. Eight, are we using one drug to treat a side effect of another drug? That happens more than I care to tell you. A person gets put on one medicine, they have problems with that medicine, they come in with complaints, and they get put on another medicine to take care of the problems. Number nine, is there a non-drug approach I can try? Can we, in fact, avoid onion rings? Can we teach ourselves to sleep better rather than taking sleeping pills? There are other things other than drugs to treat conditions, and in fact, most real health improvements involve things other than pills. And number 10, this is a tough one, Rick. Will you live long enough to get a benefit from the drug? I am not making this up. I just found out last week a person had a 102-year-old patient, and a consultant put that person on a cholesterol pill.
Wow.
102 years old, on a cholesterol pill, because let's face it, we want to try to cut down on the risk of heart disease in future years for that. And at 102, honestly, do you really think you're going to have any impact on a person's risk of heart disease?
Well, and I mean, honestly, Tony, pill? At 102, you're going to let them smoke.
Wow.
Think about it.
It was tough. I have. In fact, I did. I had a guy who was 96, and he started having cramps and couldn't feel his feet, and he wound up actually dying of lung cancer. I tried to convince him that he would actually feel better if he didn't smoke. But I will tell you, I am not starting a person who's over 100 years old on something to prevent things. That ship sailed a long time ago. We don't do colonoscopies, and we don't do cancer screening tests and so forth. You get, in my mind, once you reach 100, you get a free pass into the hospital if you feel bad that day. There are a lot of things that should happen when a person reaches 100. Preventing future problems is probably not so. Especially, these medicines have side effects. At 100, you can't take those side effects as well. This is a bad situation. That's our sponsor, Medication Simplification, when pills make you ill. And I've got a quote here from the comedic writer Dave Barry, used to write for the Miami Herald before he retired. Never under any circumstances take a sleeping pill and a laxative on the same night. It's that sort of interactions you have to watch out for. That's what we're here to talk to you about. Next up, as we mentioned in our last fractional portion, the FDA finally this month released its final regulations on deeming regulations. That is, they have said, all right, we are going to assume control of non-cigarette tobacco products. They have authority over e-cigarettes, cigars, little cigars, pipe tobacco, hookah pipes, and other tobacco products. The first thing they said was, well, you can't, minors cannot buy these products. Within 90 days, and I assume this would be by the end of the summer then, by the time Hunter actually comes back to the program, photo IDs will be required to purchase e-cigarettes, hookahs, and other products, and the sale of these in vending machines and the distribution of free samples will be prohibited. Advertising will change as well. And this is something, it is surprisingly difficult. First of all, in Europe, and particularly in the United Kingdom, people have been looking at e-cigarettes and saying, well, this is what we call harm reduction. E-cigarettes are probably probably, almost certainly, less harmful than cigarettes. So why should we not make them readily available? And this is the big argument, is that, look, these things are less harmful than cigarettes, so let's not regulate them. Let's not do anything that would impede people's access to something that's less harmful than cigarettes.
Yeah, but I think it's not so much that, Tony. I mean, yes, they may prove to be less harmful, but actually the effect they have on the human psyche, it's very much like what we're trying to deal with Diet Coke or diet drinks, right? The diet nature of them lures, it kind of rebalances or recalibrates your level of sweet. Well, an e-cig also gets you into the habit of smoking something, even though it's not smoke. And so we don't know if that's going to still contribute. And plus, there's something wrong with it being flavored. You know, a cherry. You know, that just to me sounds kiddie. It sounds like it's really setting itself up for a younger group of people who, let's be honest, I'm not trying to suggest anything but we've all been younger and at one point or another, and sometimes it's very difficult to, I mean, it's much easier as you get a little older in life to deal with some of the control issues, right?
Yeah, if you can't manage a zipper, and this was coming from our first fractional portion, to see Rick squirm a little
bit. Great to put it in perspective.
You can't manage a zipper. How are you going to manage an electronic cigarette? Back to what you were saying, you know, one of my problems is, well, it's less harmful than cigarettes. That is true. And it is also true that it is less harmful than a gunshot wound to your intestines. If that is, in fact, the standard you use, oh, well, it's less harmful than something that is very harmful, so why not just not regulate it? Let's put it in the kids' lungs, because, after all, it's less harmful than that. I think we have a higher standard. If you're going to put a chemical in kids' lungs, you need to have a standard other than, well, it's not the most harmful thing we could put in kids' lungs. That bothers me. I think the other thing that bothers me is it really, that type of harm reduction, I'm willing to concede that there could be some harm reduction from that. That is, that using e-cigarettes in place of combustible tobacco, regular cigarettes. The problem is we've not really seen good evidence that that's so. As a quitting device, they don't seem to work that well. Now, again, in the United Kingdom, there is some research that says they do help people quit. That research did not impress the FDA, does not impress me. The problem with e-cigarettes is they work just like regular cigarettes. They get drug into your brain very fast, and that's not the way you come off drugs, is to take a very fast-acting drug and slam it into your brain. That's why nicotine patches, which release nicotine over a period of time, or nicotine gum, which is a slow-release formulation, that's why they work. That's the way we treat alcohol withdrawal. We don't slam drugs into the brain to treat addiction. In fact, if we're going to have withdrawal, we use long-acting, slow-acting medicines, and e-cigarettes are anything but that.
Right.
So mechanistically, I don't think that they will get you off cigarettes. They may have harm reduction, but right now we don't even know the chemicals that are in them. This is not water vapor. It is a kind of a form of antifreeze, I don't know the long-term effects. I'm willing to concede that they are better than cigarettes, but I'm not willing to concede that that is my standard, and go ahead and spray them in the kids' lungs, because after all, if it's better than cigarettes, it's probably safe. Is not the direction that I would recommend going.
Yeah, I don't think we're a group that believes in relative safety, right?
Right.
So the safety shouldn't be based on, you know, be relative to some other form of safety, right? I think each thing should stand on its own merits. And
yeah,
right now, the whole thing with e-cigs is they're just better than cigarettes. Well, that's setting the bar kind of low.
Right. And
right? We can step over the bar pretty easy.
You may not even know it's there. But it's going to take about a couple of years, because they will be able to market them while they will apply to the FDA to approve their individual product, and they will actually have to show what's in it, and that will be a first. Right now, we don't know what's in e-cigarettes, so in this case, they're going to have to have the FDA made aware of the ingredients. So I think in general, we're going to see a much higher quality e-cigarette in the future, and I think a lot of these current brands are going to go off the market, because frankly, they do not have the quality assurance that they need to be a product in the U.S. market. Now, that aside, you know, Rick's other point is about gateway. If you put things in your mouth, if you're used to taking chemicals and not really asking what they are, where does that cigarettes send you. I do believe that e-cigarettes will be the delivery mechanism of choice for the future generation. That is, the idea of rolling up leaves in a tube and setting fire to them is going to seem terribly caveman.
Draconian?
Yeah, well, Neanderthal, actually, to young people, when you can dial the amount of chemicals you want and vaporize them in an e-cigarette. And that includes everything from marijuana to tobacco to other drugs. It's just, if you want to get it to your brain quickly, stick it in an e-cigarette, and it's a lot cleaner, it's a lot neater, it doesn't make any smell. It's a lot better than those old, nasty cigarettes. So I think cigarettes in general will be eventually on their way out. That's just for what it's worth. The FDA, though, first has to make sure that the alternatives, we understand the chemicals are in them, and then we can make a more informed choice about e-cigarettes and so forth. And that doesn't even get us to the cigars and to the hookah pipes. I just don't know where that's going to go, honestly. Next up, insurance companies. You know, Rick,
when was the last time we really beat on an insurance company?
Well, one of the reasons
you've turned pro-insurance on me, haven't you?
I have turned less anti-insurance because these guys are in a little bit of trouble.
Are they? Oh, yeah. You feel sorry for them now?
No, I don't feel sorry for them.
Really? They got billions of dollars and we feel sorry for them?
They do have billions of dollars.
That's billions with a B.
Yes, it is. All right, May 4th, Louisville, Kentucky, Humana may pull out of the Affordable Care Act exchanges in some states in 2017. It's currently selling in 15 states. It's looking at possibly pulling out of, they said, certain states. Their first quarter earnings fell 46% due to higher costs on individual plans. And this has been a problem with the Affordable Care Act. It seems that in most of the exchanges where these insurance companies are participating, they were told there would be a certain ratio of healthy people to unhealthy people. And what they found was the ratio was not as advertised. That is, the Affordable Care Act has been absolutely great for unhealthy people to get insurance, people with chronic illnesses, people with chronic disabilities to get insurance. They've never been able to do that before. The problem is the cost of insuring and caring for those people is driving the price up for everybody else, and it was beyond what the insurance companies planned for. United Health, back in January, they announced that they were going to probably lose in 2015 and 2016 about $1 billion with a B dollars on the exchange plans. They still, their profit still increased almost 4% over the past year. They had a $5.81 billion profit. So again, Rick, there's no reason to feel sorry for United Health, but that profit, interestingly enough, is not coming from selling insurance on the state exchanges. And in April 19th, they confirmed that they were, in fact, going to limit their financial exposure. They'll exit all but a handful of Affordable Care Act marketplaces next year. And I think what they're looking for, and this is, Kentucky is not going to show up well on this, they're looking for exchanges where there are relatively more healthy people, relatively more health-conscious people, and relatively fewer people who are, in fact, chronically ill. Now, United Health, they charge more than the other insurance plans, but they give you a wider number of doctors and hospitals you can go to, and that's great if you're healthy. They can make that work. But if you're sick, one of the ways that insurance companies have tried to get you to take their plan is to drop the price but narrow the number of doctors you can see to make it harder to see them. And United Health has not followed that model, so they are not in a very strong competitive position in a lot of the marketplaces. And so their departure will not cost the states individually a whole lot. But when you see two major insurance companies exiting the marketplaces, it does raise some concern. Because they beefed up their revenues before they started, knowing that this might be difficult, and yet still the number of sick people on these exchanges exceeded their estimates. And these people are very good at making estimates and protecting their wealth, and instead they're just getting out of the market altogether. Does raise a question, though, Rick. What does an insurance company do when they don't sell insurance? Apparently,
yeah, I don't know. They set up a lemonade stand?
I don't know.
I mean,
they're apparently so rich, they have so much in reserve that they don't even need to sell insurance anymore. To pay their stockholders and to generate profits. They can do that without selling insurance, which is strange.
Very strange. Very strange.
So I'm not crying any tears, but we do have to watch this. The great thing about the Affordable Care Act was it allowed people with chronic illnesses and people with disabilities to get insurance where they couldn't get it before. The bad thing, the thing that may doom the Affordable Care Act as far as cost containment goes, is that very same thing, that many people who had no access to medical care, who had no access to doctors, in fact now do But the problem is that you can't do that for free. And no, you're not going to save money ever by treating people and making them live longer. The longer we all live, the more money it costs to take care of us. That is a fact of life. And as a doctor, I believe that. I think that people should get that medical care, but it's not going to be free. It's going to be, we have to recognize that there is a financial cost to that. Okay, enough on insurance.
You got 3 minutes.
I know. All right, two states have obesity rates below 20%. Colorado, definitely one of them. The other one?
As much as they're eating these days?
Colorado's eating a lot?
Well, it's marijuana.
Ah. No, it turns out, this is the strangest thing. It turns out
they have the munchies all the
people
time.
People on marijuana in general weigh less. So there is that munchy thing, but apparently in general, it's the opposite. So I expect Colorado will not gain weight because they have legalized recreational marijuana. But Colorado's one of them, 19.8%, and that's below 20%. The lowest in the nation is no longer Colorado, though. It is Hawaii at 18.5%. West Virginia, the highest. And that's a bit of a surprise to me, because I figured Mississippi far and away would be the highest. It is not. West Virginia, the highest, slightly higher than Mississippi. So it's odd. Kentucky's dropped to number two in our smoking rates. We are not the worst in obesity, although we're in the top 10. At least one in three adults is obese in Mississippi, Delaware, Arkansas, and Oklahoma. And again, West Virginia at 37% tops the nation. This was a Gallup poll. And it was published back on May 11th, I believe. The national obesity rate up to 28%, up from 25% in 2008 when they started. 14 states significantly increased their obesity rates from 2008 to 2015. No state had a significant decline.
So did you just say no state had a
decline in obesity since 2008? None.
Wow.
Zero. Everyone.
That's depressing, isn't it?
Yeah, the best we can do is Colorado, which is holding steady and barely below, just a couple of decimal points below 20% rates. Of the 18 states with obesity rates of at least 30%, all but one located in the South or Midwest. The 11 with the lowest were located in the Northeast or West. There is something about living in the middle part of America that our diet, our lifestyle, something like that makes us more likely. Medical costs for an obese person, about $1,400 per year, more than a person of normal weight. This, again, cost all of us extra. Another reason why insurance companies are reluctant to come to some of these states. And they are leaving states like Georgia and some of the southern states. Interviews conducted from January to December 2015. That's how they got their numbers. So not much news on it. It had stalled for a while. We thought perhaps, well, maybe we're starting to get this obesity thing licked. No, in fact, we're not. Apparently, if you stay and sit at a desk all day, and if you eat a lot of food that you shouldn't eat, and you don't exercise at all, for some reason you get fat. Who knew? What a surprise.
We hope you still listen to the radio, though.
Yep. We're going to take a break, try to get some exercise, do something about our obesity rates. Why don't you do the same and join us for our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Bathroom of Your Birth show. Again, we are in the process of a two-show send-off to our student producer, Hunter Reese, who is returning to his home state of North Carolina. We could not let that go without causing him some discomfort as we talked about the mess that is now the bathroom law in North Carolina. Our sponsor for the final time, Medication Simplifications. When pills make you ill, reminding you, Rick, like this, Dave Barry, a columnist and humorist for formerly for the Miami Herald, syndicated, wrote several books and a movie script, but he also made this famous quote, never under any circumstances take a sleeping pill and a laxative on the same night. I will race through these just to remind you, your healthcare provider needs to know all your medications. It is easier if you do it at one pharmacy, but we understand you may not. If you do not, you need to make sure that you bring your medications into your visits, that you keep a list of your medications, and and keep it up to date with the way you actually take those medicines, not necessarily the way you were directed to take them 5 or 10 years ago. The second question, are you on any medications that are in fact harmful? Some medications for your condition or interacting with other medications may actually cause you harm. Those need to be trimmed from your list. Three, are they all indicated? In some cases, they may have been indicated at another time in your life, or they were indicated when you were in the hospital. No one bothered to discontinue them, and the medical record has now gotten muddy. We're not sure why they were even started. I'm embarrassed to say this. That sounds absolutely awful. What do you mean your healthcare provider doesn't even know if you should be on the medication? And yet, with the awful way that our medical records are now constituted, with the fact that we don't have enough time to spend with patients, you can, in fact, see a healthcare provider and them not be aware that you're on a medication that's not indicated. Maybe a specialist started it. Maybe I don't have all your records. Maybe that diagnosis is in error for whatever reason. I'm not sure whether that's indicated or not. It's embarrassing, but it is true. Four, have they outlived their utility? If you've been on a medication for 20 or 30 years, and this famously happens, a person puts on Valium when they're in their 40s. They come to me in their 80s and they say, I don't know why I get confused and I'm sleepy all the time. And I say, it's the Valium. And they say, no, I've been taking that Valium for 40 years. If it were Valium, I would know. And then this is my famous quote, you have never been this old before in your life. And I think it's the Valium.
Who taught you that?
I don't know.
You picked that up from somebody, right?
Yeah, I suppose. I am a amalgam.
You're a copycat when it comes to that sort of
thing.
Yeah,
I have medical heroes, guys that were able to explain things to their patients well. And so most of the stuff I say is not in any way original. But I don't know where that one came from. But it will happen on a very regular basis. A person will come in having taken a medication for over a decade and confused that now, of all times, that medication might be causing side effects. So have they outlived their utility? Many have. It is not true that the medicines that worked for you a decade ago are continuing to work for you in the same way. Your metabolism changes. Your condition changes. They may not be good. Do the side effects outweigh the potential benefit? As we said, we tend to maximize the benefits, minimize the side effects. But a sober look at that may change the equation. Are there interactions between the two different drugs or the drug and the disease? As I mentioned, some diseases are made worse. Parkinson's is one famously made worse by a lot of GI medicines and nausea medicines. Prostate problems made worse by sinus medications. Some heart conditions made worse by breathing medicines, things like that that you don't know. Is the medication, in fact, bothering a disease or is it affecting another drug? Seven, what about non-prescription drugs, over-the-counter drugs, supplements, herbal medications? Do not think because it's herbal that it has no interactions whatsoever. Every one of those things has to go through your liver, through your bloodstream, and go to some place where it has its action, and they can get in each other's way. Eight, is it being used to treat the side effect of another drug? That happens more than you can imagine. Person gets put on a fluid pill and then gets put on a cramp pill and then gets put on a pill for gout, all of which are caused by the fluid pill. Nine, is there a non-drug approach I can try? Well, there's a thought. What if we simply turn the TV off, stop working with our electronic stuff, and went to bed instead of taking a sleeping pill? And 10, will I live long enough to get a benefit? And a lot of risk reduction strategies we have were based on people in their 40s and 50s. They do not work well at age 90 or 100. That's our medication questions. That's our medication simplification when pills make you ill. And I did, to credit this, I got this from a guy named Amir Shah, who was at the American College of Physicians meeting in Washington, D.C. I thought that was a neat thing. And to keep that theme going, Rick, Johns Hopkins published May 3rd, the British Medical Journal. I'm sure you saw the headline, medical errors kill more than a quarter of a million
Everybody
people.
Everybody saw that one.
Yeah.
Third leading cause of death now.
Yeah. 250,000 medical errors, 150,000 respiratory disease. Now, the problem with it is this. You do not have on the death certificate, you do not have this person died because of a medication error.
Right.
That's not the way it works. Now, to understand errors, I want people to understand this. This was not that your doctor was drunk. This was not that you have a stupid healthcare provider who was completely unaware of your diagnosis. This is the sort of thing where you had a person who made a diagnosis, which was probably right, a person started a treatment, which on paper looked like it was right, but the name of the medicine got garbled, the doses was wrong, somebody else's medication was given to you instead of to them, the route was wrong, it was given through the IV catheter instead of through the feeding tube. That sort of of thing, those type of errors. So again, if you're on 15 or 20 different medicines, the chances of this goes up. This is not, though, when we talk about medical errors, we're not talking about people being stupid or not caring. We're talking about the fact that our system doesn't catch these things. Now, the original ones, which a lot of us doctors really didn't like, they took people who were hospitalized on a neurosurgery ward, and they figured out their error rates, and then they extrapolated that to all hospitalizations. Now, neurosurgeons spend a lot more time in the OR than they do taking care of their patients on the ward. That's the nature of neurosurgery. So a lot of us thought that that was wrong. This is a little bit better numbers and a little bit better information, but still, it's a guess. And when you say the third leading cause of death, that gets everybody's attention.
Right, and that's what happened. The third leading cause of death made its way through Facebook, and you know, I even thought about putting that up on our site, and I thought, well, you know, everybody's going to see that anyway. So
yeah, they did hospital admission rates from 2013. And there were 34 million hospitalizations. They looked at four different studies that analyzed medical death rates. So they're going to include that neurosurgery study that bothered me so much because I did not think that was typical for people in the hospital. Now, so they got 250,000. And I can say, well, I know one of those studies probably overestimated it. What about the other three? Well, that's possible. But here's my problem, Rick. These are all inpatient studies. They haven't even begun to look at medical errors in the clinics, in the outpatient setting. And so I think it would be hard for me to argue that quarter of a million death figure because they didn't
even consider.
Yeah, I think they may have overestimated the inpatient part, but since they didn't include an outpatient part, yeah, it could be that much or it could be a little higher
as well. You think the outpatient part could lead to death, though?
Yeah, you know.
It's a little harder?
It's complicated. We're not talking about, I mean, I suppose overdose deaths. And, you know, we've lost 500,000 people in the past decade to overdose.
Right.
So overdose deaths in Kentucky alone, it's over 1,000. People a year. So that overdose death, that's just the problem is some people tried. They took too many pills or they partied too hard. But some of those overdoses were because we prescribed a couple of medicines together and the interaction caught up with the patient. Methadone's famous for that. It's a very long-acting medicine. It lasts longer than you think, and you may be feeling okay on the methadone, but then you add a second pain medicine or a sleeping pill to it, and all of a sudden total amount is just more than your body can stand. So, you know, we've got those type of things that I know happen, and I've certainly seen it in mine. But a lot of these others, they don't necessarily cause you to stop breathing. That error didn't make you stop breathing. But those two medicines taken together make you sick, and they start a cascade of events that leaves you hospitalized and winds up taking away your health. So I think it's – I don't want to overstate those numbers. They are an extrapolation, and it's a big round number, 250,000, because there's no way we can count it accurately. But what I'm saying, and this is why we talked about medication simplification, is we've got to make things simpler and more transparent. We're losing too many people within the system. And I'll say it again, it's embarrassing to be providing health care with so much uncertainty when you would think that if we computerized things, we would know everything about you.
Yeah, we're still, you know, when was it? It was mandatory, I think, for the electronic medical health record was, I think, in 2014. I think it was mandated. Otherwise, you were going to start losing your federal payments. So we're just still on that, 18-month window of having this data sets get captured. Now we're in this analytical phase, right? You see everything. Move into the analytics. How do we get the big data out? How do we scrub it? How do we polish it? How do we find that pretty little needle that we need, you know, of information? And I think, you know, it's the problem is data mining, all the practice of data mining right now is very specialized. It requires, you know, a lot of research crews. You know, it's not just, Tony, I mean, you and I are fairly intelligent people, right? We work in sometimes complex jobs, but these data miners, they are, likewise, they're doing very complex work and they're very specialized. And so we haven't made the tools readily available so that you can get a lot of people doing the mining. Does that make sense?
It does. You know,
until we get a big number of miners, we're going to have a hard time pulling out the data.
Yeah, so I understand what you're saying. We forced implementation here. We have some computer systems that are maybe not the best. We don't necessarily have the best data mining techniques, but I'm going to throw that back at you, Rick. As we get better mining techniques, we're also going to get flooded with data. Everybody's going to dump their Fitbits
Absolutely.
Into the medical record
Absolutely.
And so forth. And so the data is going to overwhelm our technique, I think.
But the Fitbit data, that sort of stuff, the companies that are doing that are preparing for it on the back end. I think where we're still struggling is to get that overall health record. The thing that has because it's kind of the glue that holds all that other information together, right? And so once we get the history, so how many surgeries have you had? How many times have you been, you know, people that have had 1,000 medical visits in their life, you know, they may be in a different category of research or data sets. So I think until you kind of put that whole piece together, the glue that holds that other stuff together, I think it's going to, that's when you're going to see the things like Watson, some of the big data systems that are going to try to pull all that information. That's when they're going to start being most effective in detecting trends, projecting, right? You'll get out of that reactive and go into the proactive mode. And I think that in itself is going to be a major shift for us. But I guess my point is, Tony, yes, all those Fitbit wearables, all that technology is growing rapid on the fringes or the edges of the health record. The problem is it's still going to take a while to get that information out of the health record. It's in there. We're mining it, or actually we're not mining it. We're growing it. We're still figuring out how to get the ore out, right?
Yeah. Hey, you think of these science fiction studies where basically the computers track your every move, and you look at what happened in healthcare, and simply the amount of data is so overwhelming.
Right.
That whole tracking thing is I think a bit of a myth. I'll tell you another myth. While we're on it, I'll try to be quick about this because I do have one more thing I want to talk about. I've been to several conferences where people insist that your medical record belongs to you. That is, you the consumer.
I'll give it to you if you can read it.
Well, and that's I guess that's where I am. Is, you know, all right, if this belongs to you, try getting it sometime, and then determining who's accessed it in the past 6 months and so forth. In fact, I don't think it belongs to you. I don't think it belongs to me. I think it belongs to the hospital. When it comes down to it, it belongs to the computer company because they can shut down their servers and just take it with them. And
well,
they have.
That's a whole different topic that we can go down and talk about one of your future shows. But, you know, a lot of the biggest medical health information record companies right now are moving to a cloud environment. So now you don't even have the data stored on your own premise.
Yeah.
Right? You may have a copy of it somewhere, but you don't even have the major data. So if they decide they go out of business, decide to turn off the servers, now granted, you got legal and there's business associate agreements that you put in place to where you can always have that data. But still, it's not like you walk down the hall and open the door to your data center and you just go get it.
Right. And it's not like people are constantly applying for permission to see your records. In fact,
exactly.
A lot of people can't.
I know. You're over time, but you got to get
one
more thing.
So, Rick, this next article makes me very happy. This was April 15th.
You finally getting your way?
Well, I think finally some voice of reason comes to the FDA.
So what you're saying, Health Matters was right?
Yeah. Actually, now that you brought it up, absolutely that's correct. We've had this drug, niacin, and I hate this drug. I really do not like this drug.
You're not supposed to hate anything, Tony.
I know, but I have no love for this drug in my heart.
You're supposed to love everything.
I most certainly am not, and I'm developing new hates even as we speak. Now, niacin was FDA approved to lower cholesterol, and they thought it might raise your good cholesterol. And the studies on it, I read them, they were not very good. My first patient who was on niacin was this elderly lady who had been put on it for the wrong reason. She came to the emergency room. She had a flushing reaction, and it feels as if you are on fire. I told her it was the drug. I said it wouldn't happen again. She was so terrified. She did not want to go home from the emergency room even after she knew what it was. And that was my first experience. I look at the literature. It's no good. I look at the side effects. They are horrendous. And I hated this drug from the start. Well, the FDA back in 1997 approved niacin for several indications. And a few years later, they said, well, you could combine it with a statins for treatment of high cholesterol and especially to raise the good cholesterol level. This is a very rare thing. They withdrew their approval of niacin for use with other cholesterol medications. They did the same thing for something called phenofibric acid or Trilipix. They've been used in combination. The FDA approval no longer. It stood since 2008. They said, you know, the new evidence on side effects and outcomes says that this should not be approved. We were very excited about that. Finally, some sense coming from the FDA. Niacin in combination with other cholesterol-lowering drugs doesn't really work very well. So I got to say, you're right, Rick. This makes me feel good. I had a good afternoon when I read this from the FDA.
We were right. They were wrong. Nanny, nanny, boo-boo.
And now, on that note, can you get us off the air?
Special thanks to Morehead State Public Radio producer Hunter Reese and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song. And to you, our loyal radio fans, remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to our show, go to WMKY.org or just visit us on Facebook. Do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew, and particularly for Hunter Reese, happy trails as he goes on his summer vacation, and also the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show, and remember,
Health Matters is a prescription radio show used along with diet to raise good cholesterol levels and lower bad cholesterol levels. Listening to Health Matters with another cholesterol-lowering radio show does not reduce heart attacks or strokes more than any other radio show alone.
Health Matters is not for people with liver problems. You got liver problems, we're not for you. Stomach ulcers, serious bleeding problems, or those allergic to any product ingredients.
Severe liver damage has occurred when switching to a long-acting health radio show such as Health Matters from a short-acting show such as Health Minute. Do not switch between radio shows without talking to your healthcare provider.
Tell your healthcare provider about any unexplained muscle pain, tenderness, or weakness, as this could be a sign of serious side effects. The risk increases when Health Matters is heard by elderly, diabetics, or those with kidney or thyroid problems.
Listen to Health Matters with caution if you consume large amounts of alcohol or you have a past history of liver disease.
Your healthcare providers should do blood tests before and during our show to check liver enzyme levels, as these can increase with listening.
Health Matters can cause an increase in blood sugar levels. If you have diabetes, check your blood sugar levels more frequently during the first few months of listening.
Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for our continuing salute to U.S. ophthalmologists on Morehead State Public Radio. Next week, we'll focus on eye doctors who can't hold their liquor, a pair of glasses, and they make a spectacle of themselves.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.